Welcome to another episode of Thinking Like a Bank, where we show you how to think like a bank by applying the same strategies and principles that banks use to help you find more financial freedom in your life. I'm your host, Sari Ibrahim.
Today, I'm interviewing Scott Peckford. Scott is the founder and host of the I Love Mortgage Brokering podcast and ILMB Network. He's the CEO and founder of BRX Mortgage Inc. As a performance-driven visionary and Canadian podcasting pioneer in the mortgage industry, Scott is passionate about supporting agent success. Since launching in July 2014, the ILMB podcast has taken the mortgage industry by storm with more than 1 million downloads and celebrating the 500th episode, airing July 2023. With over 17 years of experience as a mortgage broker, Scott brings his expertise to the table and hosts fellow top producing mortgage brokers across the country to share and discuss their best tips, tricks, and stories with listeners. Scott and I not only talk about mortgage brokering, we also talk about key concepts every business should implement, especially key ways of testing your product and market.
Scott, welcome to our podcast.
Hey man, thanks for having me on. Usually I'm the one getting to ask the question, so this is a little different for me, but it's all good.
Yeah, definitely. Before I started this podcast, I was only doing guest appearances where I would go on other people's shows. I did that for like 300 times before doing my own podcast. So it's like, it's very
really cool. Oh, yeah. Good for you, man.
Thanks. So I'm excited. You know, we were talking about a lot of really cool things before recording about entrepreneurship, failure. I want to talk about that. But before we get into that, I want to know more about you and your background.
So very briefly, in my 20s, I was a paramedic for 9 years, great career, loved it, but realized that I wanted to do something different. So then I got into the mortgage business, mortgage broker in Canada in 2006, did that for about a decade, tried a whole bunch of different experiments and some failures, which we'll touch on, some things I've learned. And then in the last sort of six years, I run a training company for mortgage brokers, or I had a training company for mortgage brokers, as well as I have a mortgage brokerage. So that's basically where brokers, if you're a mortgage broker, you got to put your license somewhere. Like you typically have to be part of a larger network. And so that's what I've been doing. But all of the stuff I've been doing, paramedic, running my mortgage business, trying other kinds of other businesses that I've got into, all of it have kind of led me to, I think Steve Jobs says you can only connect the dots looking back. So I can't make it look like it was some big master plan. It was just, oh, look at that. All these things connected to put me where we are. And so I feel grateful to be, you know, in an industry that's still, it's an amazing industry for sure. And I love being an entrepreneur. Like I am completely unemployable. So that's a little bit, and I got three great kids and live in Canada. So.
Awesome. That's great. And you mentioned something interesting. So I didn't know this, but when you're an independent mortgage broker, you have to park your license somewhere. You can't just
typically when you have a license, especially for the first 2 years, there's different designations. So there's like a, depending on the province you're in, I'm sure it's similar in the States, but there's different designations and one person can have like a bunch of people underneath them. Ultimately, what the regulator wants is like whose neck is in the noose if somebody screws up.
Okay.
And so I have a mortgage company now, and initially I was part of another mortgage company. And so my neck is in the noose in all of our provinces. And so if somebody screws up in an area, then it would fall back on me as the owner of the company. And so there's risks to that, but there's also opportunities in being able to grow, you know, much bigger than you could on your own. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how that works.
And how has the industry changed over the last couple of years with the interest rates changing?
Oh, well, I mean, up until like halfway through last year, it was bonkers. Like you could barely keep up. And then all of a sudden it was like I always liken the economy to like a, it's like a house party, right? And the music's going, they got kegs, and then the police show up and then the parties. And that's kind of what happened in the middle of 2022. It was like, what happened to the party? Like we were all having so much fun. And now we're settling into this new reality of what's going on. And there's going to be a cycle for this. This is not going to be gone overnight. Yeah. But I still have agents that work for me that are doing fantastic. And you just have to go out and find the new opportunity. So I don't think I've heard it described once, and I really like this metaphor. It's like the economy is like a tennis match. And so when the ball hits the ground, you're either happy or sad, depending on which side of the net you're on. And as an entrepreneur, we can adjust what side of the net we're on. We can be like, oh, dang, I'm on the wrong. So I always think like, okay, if the market's shifting, I got to change what I'm doing. And so that I take advantage of these market shifts. And so that's my, you know, the way I think about that.
Right.
Yeah, here in the US, I talked to some mortgage brokers and loan officers, and they say the same thing. They say that they were super, super busy and things have slowed down, but they say they're still kind of busy compared to like pre-2020. They say they're still busier than that time. I think it's just because of the demand for wanting to buy, and then the alternative, which is renting. I'm sure Canada's the same way, especially where you're at. Rent has gone up a lot, so it's kind of like
it's crazy. Yeah,
it's crazy.
So yeah, if people can buy, they will. I think that there's still the problem, fundamentally, the problem, at least in Canada, and every obviously real estate's localized, so I'm speaking in general terms, is that we have a supply shortage, and we immigrated about 500,000 people a year into Canada. But we're not, which is awesome. I think it's great because we're bringing in new people, new skills, like great, you know, but we're not building real estate fast enough for all these people. Where are they going to live? And so this is, and you can't fix that problem quickly. It's not like you can, and playing with interest rates is that the government's trying to do is not going to change that, because you got, when you're, let's say you're going to do a building, well, you got to get permits through a city approved. You've got to get design done. You've got to then find the tradespeople to do the work. And then you like all of that. And then you got development costs. And so like all that stuff means that the I think that, you know, and you guys deal with investment people. I think that there's going to be some, at least this is, I'm going to speak to Canadian market. I don't know. And this is, again, very niche, but there's going to be some inventory come on the market in the next, if the rates stay high prolonged. There's people that are kind of the, like they were the novice investor that maybe don't have the financial resources to be able to, this is just another one of those cycles. If they feel they're a little bit stressed, or maybe some of them will dump some of their investment properties. Mm-hmm. So that means that some of them may come on the market, but I don't think it's significant enough to make like, you know, a huge, there might be some buying opportunities for the smart investor. The person who has cash and an investor will have opportunities. Somebody who's stretched themselves a little too thin, maybe they're going to have to dump something. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, but I feel like there's going to be opportunities, but that's still not going to fix the supply shortage. Like you just can't supply, like we can't build 500, you know, we don't need 500,000 units, but we need a lot of units to offset the people that are coming into the country. So.
Right. Exactly. But even with building then, cause you need loans to build. And then if those loans are constricted, then it's like, how do you get capital into the economy then?
Yeah. So capital is another constraint that I think, like, you know, in our market, we've seen more and more people. If you think of I always think of the lending pool as like a sandbox, and it used to be really big back when I started. Like if you could fog a mirror, I could get you a loan. Be like, yes, you qualify, but I can hear you breathing in the other end of the line. Now it's like, no. Like that pool has gotten much smaller, but there's always alternative lending options out there. And so this is where having somebody who's really good at this stuff is going to be helpful. They're not like, from a mortgage broker's perspective, if you're good, there's lots of opportunity because it's more challenging. It's not as easy. Like there were programs where literally it was like, if you had good credit, it's like, sure. Now it's like, you need to really be good at your job to be successful at some of those more challenging files.
And then alternative lending, that's like, can you give us an example of alternative lending?
So let's say somebody who, I think they call it non-QM in the US, so it's non-qualifying mortgages. And so what we would consider like somebody who comes to us, and let's say their tax return says, you know, we don't use a W-2, but their tax return says that they made $25,000 a year last year, but their actual cash flows are like $30,000, $40,000 a month in their business, but they're not writing it. They got some retained earnings. And so you can look at the monthly cash flow of the business, and we can lend based on the monthly cash flow, not based on what they're paying in taxes. So that's just one example of types of loans that are available, that where you could be like, oh, okay, we're not going to qualify it based on, because your taxable income is nothing. Mm-hmm. Because you've got a really good accountant and he doesn't want you to pay tax and you don't want to pay tax. So either you pay tax. So either you can, you know, pull them as much money as you can to your business to pay tax, and then which is a big number, or you can pay a slightly higher interest rate, which is only on the mortgage. In most cases, for especially smart business people, they're like, I'd rather pay a higher interest rate than more tax, because more tax is like, you know, in Canada, they love to tax things. Like it moves, we tax it. If it stops moving, we tax it. If it thinks about moving, it's ridiculous. So, you know, there are opportunities for good mortgage brokers to do those types of, you know, but it's not all created equal for sure.
Right. I see that from that perspective, right? It's like instead of paying taxes, but an alternative, like a higher interest rate, because now you own a property now. Instead of losing that money to taxes, you now own a property, and then you build your portfolio, you build your net worth, you build more collateral for other properties in the future. So it's like, which way, which route do you want to take, you know?
So, and if you think about it with income, the way the banks look at it, again, qualifying. So let's say you need a 2-year average. So let's say you paid yourself $100,000 a year for 2 years in order to get qualify. And that is, let's say, just for easy math, $30,000, $35,000 of tax per year. So $70,000, let's say, right? And, or you keep paying yourself $25,000 a year and you pay a slightly higher interest rate. But it's not going to be the same. The difference is not the $75,000 you paid in tax. You're going to be, it's going to be less. And so you, it's always about, it's a math equation ultimately. And what mortgage, the smart mortgage brokers like about these type of clients is that it's just math. It's not like, they're not like, oh, I'm worried about point whatever on the mortgage. It's like, no, it's like, I'm paying way less tax. I'm still getting the real estate. So I'm happy as long as all the rest of it works. So I feel like those type of things are very, you know, they're definitely more common now than they were even 12 months ago.
So that's an interesting thing I want to talk about for the, from the mortgage broker standpoint. Do they have like software that can like plug in this data and then it'll calculate the difference whether they.
Yeah. So there are like what we call loan origination software where we put in to do the math. So think of it like a big fancy spreadsheet and it pulls in credit info and liabilities and stuff. And the, but at the end of the, and then there's some, there are platforms that have like lender guidelines, but it's not like, it's not binary. It's not like 1 + 1 = 2 always. It's funny because people think like, oh, it should, if it was completely binary, they would actually replace all the people that underwrite mortgages. They'd replace them with software.
Yeah.
But they can't because there's a nuance. It's like, okay, we got to, you know, and maybe some, at some point, sure, they may be able to replace a lot of those back end roles with software, but there is still a human component because every file is slightly different in every, like there's just so many variables that you can look at to just make a decision on whether, and they, at the end of the day, they want to lend money. They make money when they lend money. So, but they got to justify it. And so there isn't a 1 + 1 = 2. And so, and the other part is that if you're a good mortgage broker, your relationships with your lenders really matter. So I've got a friend who's one of the top mortgage brokers in the country. And he works with a company called Scotia Bank. They're a pretty big lender. Mm-hmm. And I have another friend. So this guy does about 400 million a year in mortgages. And this other friend does about 70 million. Both of them are like, you know, the one guy's top 1%, the other guy's top 0.001%. And the top 1% guy, he sends his file into Scotia and they're like, we can't do it. And the other guy goes, give it to me, I'll get it done. And he sends in the exact same file. He does not, there's no fraud, there's no funny business in it.
Yeah.
It is just that his relationship with them is such that they're like, we will do this for you, because you sent us 300 million last year and we like you and we will do. And so that's the kind of thing that you can't put that in a formula of 1 + 1 = 2. It's like, 1 + 1 = 2 for you. But for this other guy, he's getting 1 + 1 = 3. So then it's like, oh, so again, it comes back to anybody listening to this. And I'm sure if they're experienced, they understand the value of having a really good mortgage person, whoever that is, in their corner, because it makes a big difference for sure.
Right. That's because what if you're the client on that end then, and you want the loan obviously to go through to buy your investment property or your property to live in, you're going to want to work with the mortgage broker who has those kinds of connections.
Because the relationship still matters, because it's not just linear. And if it was, we would, you know, they would replace tons of those jobs. And so there is what they call auto adjudication, which is a software that reads the application to try to spit out an answer, but even that's not 100%, you know. And when you get into investor files, the complexity goes up. Self-employed, like if it's a straight, you got a teacher and an engineer, they got this much down, they got no payments, credit, like those, okay, sure, those can be auto adjudicated pretty darn quick. But anything that gets complex with multiple properties or multiple companies or anything, that is not getting auto adjudicated. There is a person going to have to look at that thing and go, Is this a deal we should do? Because it's different.
So tell us more about like your experience as an entrepreneur. Before we started recording, you mentioned failure and how you look at failure differently. So kind of a two-part question. Tell us about your experience as an entrepreneur and tell us what you think about failure.
Sure. Well, man, I tell you, I found more ways to fail than not. And so the first thing I think about when it comes to failure is that I define failure as just feedback. And I read this study once that talked about how they had taught these startup founders. They had two groups of startup founders, and they taught one group to think like scientists. So like, hey, you're a startup founder, you got this great idea, and you are a scientist. It's a hypothesis. Go out and test it. And if it doesn't work, adjust it. That group earned 40 times more than the group that was just taught to be like good business principles. And I think it's because we can become married to our identity of this is my idea, you know, or somebody listening to this, I only do fix and flips, or I only buy this type of real estate. And so your identity gets tied into something and then you can't make adjustments. And so I think of like failure is just feedback. I have an idea, a hypothesis on something. I will run an experiment and then I will get the feedback. And either it turned out like way as I expected, which is 20 to 30% of the time. And then 70 to 80% of the time, it doesn't. Sometimes it's literally a dumpster fire that you're like, man, that was a mess. Mm-hmm. And you're roasting marshmallows over this dumpster fire of your idea. And then, but you're learning. And I'm just like, I don't take that personally. It's not my identity. It's like, oh, I had a hypothesis. It didn't work. And, you know, and I've developed that habit of thinking over the last like, 15, you know, almost 17 years of being self-employed. And so I'm happy to share some examples of like, you know, just some of them dumpster fires, but then how they actually, there was lessons in every single one of them, if you like.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I think that the hypothesis thing is really intriguing because I feel like that's kind of in a way when you become experienced as an entrepreneur, you can copy and paste those formulas or those methods you have and apply them to other businesses, even businesses outside of your industry, because you're going in from the standpoint of like a scientist and not necessarily a passionate entrepreneur.
Right. And you're like, oh, this is, I have to do this because this is, it's like, no. Like maybe not. Yeah. And is this the best way to do it? Maybe not. Like, and I'm a big fan of testing. So I'll tell you a quick story about a business that I got into and then why I believe in testing small. And so a friend of mine back in like 2008, so I've been a mortgage broker for a bit, and I saw that the big, you know, there was a subprime crisis, and everywhere you saw was credit karma, credit monitoring. We thought credit monitoring was the thing. We're like, in the US, all the football games and credit monitoring, like, oh man, this is going to be big business. So we thought, my buddy and I were like, we're going to start one of these in Canada. When credit monitoring is essentially you pay a subscription for somebody to keep, you know, so you can keep tabs on your credit score. And so you can basically be like a reseller. So if you think of like these companies that do it, they just house the data, but you can actually get their data for one price and resell it for another price and be the in between. So that's what these companies that you hear right now, that's what they're doing. And so my buddy and I, we cooked up this business plan. We had spreadsheets. And if you looked at the spreadsheets, they look like a hockey stick. Like they literally were like really low. And then all of a sudden it just took off. And it was like, and this guy's got tons of like education, really smart. Showed it to my wife. She's like, this is a terrible idea. Like, how are you going to make money? How are you going to find customers? Like, no, you know what you're talking about. And I met a friend of mine who's in his 70s. We met him for lunch, my business partner and I, and we're like, hey, we got to show you our idea because this guy is a very successful entrepreneur. And so we sat there and we told him all of our ideas and what we're going to do. And he's like, have you guys tested this? And we're like, no, this is like the internet, man. We don't need that. It was like 2008, 2009, right? And he's like, okay. And then 6 months later, I phone him up and say, hey, man, so remember that business I did? I lost 67 grand personally, completely like blew up. And I think I got my MBA in business. And he's like, you don't have your MBA yet. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I lost $1 million on a business idea that I had. Let me tell you about that. And so then he proceeds to tell me about his story of losing $1 million on something he didn't test. So since that time, I am a huge, I try to test things small. What's the smallest test I can run to test to see if there's a market? Is there a customer? Like you can have this idea that people will pay you for something if you're selling to customers, but if they don't want to pay you, like if they don't want to give you, if people say, yeah, I'm definitely going to buy it. You know, if you let's say you're pitching your idea to people and they're like, yeah, it's a great idea. I would definitely buy it. Awesome. Give me your credit card. Well, I mean, that's when if they won't give you a credit card, you know that you don't have something. If they give you their credit card, you know you have an idea that's like,
yeah.
So and now I'm very big fan of like building things before or selling them before they're even fully built. And so that was a $67,000 loss, which at the time was a big loss for me. It was like, that sucked. I was like, you know, punch in the guts. The distraction was a major problem. Fast forward to about 6 years ago, so back to learning, I decide, a friend of mine phones me, I'm in San Francisco, and says, hey, you should get into training mortgage brokers. You know lots about that. I'm like, okay, so maybe I should do that. So I write up an email. I have a big email list of mortgage brokers, and I send out this email. I basically write a plan for what I'm going to train on. Mm-hmm. And in that email, I said, I'm going to teach you this, 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 and this. Here's what it costs. If you want to buy it, click here. And had a payment thing. Sent that thing out. We sold like $37,000, $35,000 of training in two or three emails.
Oh, wow.
I hadn't written a single line of that training. Like not a single line of it. Like all I had was a tape. Think of it this way. It was like a book with a table of contents and that's it. And I knew the material, but I was like, I had collected $35,000 on an idea before I even did a single stitch of work.
Wow.
And so I would never have done that if I hadn't lost money the first time by going, we've got this great idea with no plan to market it. If I would have been out trying to sell those credit monitoring, trying to sell them, I would have probably quickly realized we have a major problem. Like this is not, but people weren't really that keen on it. It was, you know, it was not, it was too early. And the people that got into that business early, most of them raised money from other people, like a whole piles of money, and then they could spend it and hope that with the hopes that that would actually work. I know that's one model for business. My model has always been, I got to test this. And if I can't find somebody to pay me for this, then I don't have a good idea. So it's an example of like a lesson that I learned, and then how I later on, now I apply a different philosophy to stuff. I'm like, if I can't get a customer, I'm not interested in like, and so if I'm a real estate investor, I don't know if this is possible. Is there a way for you to like, if you're getting into a new market, a new area, is there a way for you to test your hypothesis before you chase it with a whole bunch of money? Right. Like, and you know, that's what I would try to do, because then you can put more energy behind stuff that's actually going to work. So that's a couple examples.
You know, that's so smart. It's so simple and so smart. And yet a lot of 99% of people miss that. They go down the route of guessing, right? And kind of betting. And you do, as an entrepreneur myself, I betted a lot, right? On myself, on other people. You kind of have to do that. But you can also take small, smart steps. And that'll save you, like in your case, you know, $67,000, you know? So what's your advice for newer entrepreneurs, newer investors? How can they test out small things? Can you give us some ideas for testing things out on a smaller scale?
Sure. Well, I think if you plop me down in like wherever, somewhere in the US, say, Scott, you've got to invest in real estate in this market. Well, one of the first things I would do is find a mentor. Like you've got to there's no problem. I always say this in the mortgage business. There's no problem in your mortgage business somebody else hasn't already solved. There's no problem in real estate investment business that somebody hasn't solved. So why on earth are you going to stumble your way through this when you could find somebody? I would find local market people.
Right.
And I want people who not just talk about it, who actually do it. So it's one thing to be like, oh yeah, I know all about it, but do they actually do it? Show me the results of your decisions. And I would personally pay a mentor for, look at my deals with me. Like that's the easiest thing that you could do to save money. Like if you imagine you find a really good mentor who you say, look, I'm going to go out and I've learned this new method of whatever, real estate investing. You are an expert at it. I will pay you for every deal to review with me to give me what you do with it and whether I buy the deal or not. And sure, you may spend several thousands of dollars, you know, potentially on those reviews, but man, you would, the loss that you could prevent and the opportunities that you would miss would be, to me, well worth it. Like I wouldn't even consider it, especially if you're talking, you know, you're investing a lot of money. I would not even consider without some, and I personally like more, like you can do courses and stuff, but I do like one-on-one mentoring because I want to just tell me what you would do. Like I want to show them my deal because I'm a real estate investor. Like, yeah. What would you look at this deal? How would you negotiate it? What are the things I need to watch out for? Like that, if you have to pay them $1,000 for an hour, it's probably worth it, honestly. Yeah. Like just the, you know, but too often we get, well, I don't, you know, that, so that's what I would do. That's not really testing. But yeah. What you're doing is you're using someone else's experience that you don't have yet to help you make better decisions. And mistakes in real estate or in business can be very expensive, right? Yeah. Like, you know, you can make. So that's probably what I would do in that scenario is I would definitely not do it without a mentor. Like there's no way, like, especially if it was a new market or new property type that I wasn't as familiar with. And of course I do all my learning I could on my own, but I'd still want to have another set of eyes look at it with me.
Yeah, definitely. Because they can come with the blueprint. They can come with the methods already, the proven methods already done. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a process. 100%. You trust the process. Yeah. And then you add on your own process on top of that, right? You know, like, for example, if you have multiple mortgage brokers in your agency, right? They probably all have similar systems, but also they all each have their own unique ways of doing things on top of the system you train them
on. Yes. Yeah, 100%. We teach them like a formula or a method And then they're all going to take their own personality. They match their personality with their market opportunity, because I think those are important. And then that's how they create the best outcome. And so for this, an investor, you got to match your personality with your market opportunity, depending on where you're, what you're doing. And then, you know, obviously mentors. It's like I have spent, that's another thing I wish I would have learned when I was younger. You know, when I first got into mortgages, I was 30. And I took some great coaching and training, but not like I have. I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on coaching and training, and it's worth 100% worth it. Like, I would not be what I'm doing today without that stuff. And so I think that is not a waste. If you can get, as long as it's the right people, that's not a waste. And then, and not, no one mentor or one coach is going to teach you everything. Like, you're going to pick up things from each one and be like, okay, you know, so don't think that one person has all the answers. They don't. They have a few things they're probably really good at. Learn those things, and then find what's the next person you can learn a few things from.
Right. And I think the ROI is indirect, right? It's not like you're going to go to a conference, pay $20,000, and walk out of that conference and then get a deal for $20,000 to pay you. It could take years. Yep. It could take months. It could be randomly. It can come in a different way. I think you have to diversify. You have to kind of like diversify yourself, your personal development, and where you're investing, because you don't know where it's going to come back from. It will come back, and it'll come back in a multiple.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're doing live conferences, also part of it is the people you meet. Like, part of it is a networking thing. It's like, you don't know which person that you're going to make friends with that's going to open up all kinds of doors. Or so like, it's not just the training. I don't, and by the way, I don't sell any real estate investment training. Like, it's not my world, but like, you don't know who else you're going to meet, or that could, you know, be a massive opportunity for both of you. So, anyway, I think that would be one of the ways that I would test it. Yeah. And then, I think for that type of business is probably the best. That's that would be my approach anyway.
Yeah. Well, Scott, this was really a really good conversation. It was a pleasure talking to you, interviewing you. How can the listeners connect with you and learn more about you?
Well, if you want to check out what we're doing, you can go to, look me up online. I'm on Instagram and in LinkedIn and Facebook and everything. And then our mortgage company is called brxmortgage.com. And then my podcast, I Love Mortgage Brokering. It's only for mortgage. If you're not a mortgage broker, you're gonna be like, don't bother. Like, it's really just, it's very niche, but it's good. And I love learning too. So one of the things I like about the podcast is I love to learn from other people and then figure out what can I apply to my own business or my own situation, right?
Okay, I'll be sure to add in all those links you mentioned in the show notes below, and I'm looking forward to having you back on the podcast.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
To learn more about what we do and how we can help you grow more wealth, please visit www.finassetprotection.com. That's F-I-N, assetprotection.com. The topics presented in this podcast are for general information only and not for the purposes of providing legal, accounting, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult a professional who knows your specific situation.